21st Annual Life Fair here at St. John's. I'm Debbie Linnick, President and CEO of St. John's, and it's an honor and privilege to be here with you today. St. John's is proud to host the area's largest free health care. We're also pleased to be working with Missouri Southern and appreciate all of the hard work of their staff, volunteers, students, and the many St. John's employees who worked very hard to put on this event. Please join me in a round of applause. Today's health care is part of a continued effort by St. John's promote healthy lifestyles throughout the communities we serve. I hope you've had a chance to visit the many booths and informational areas here today and hear the many physicians that have had a seat on some of our very new programs. St. John's has had several new services this year, which have been featured in many of our programs today. One of those new services is our Heart Aware program. This is a new online assessment tool that allows you in the privacy of your own home to evaluate your risk of developing heart disease. As we know, heart disease is the number one killer in our country, and it's important to take an opportunity to assess your own personal risk, as well as those of your loved ones and family members. It just takes a few minutes to complete, and for many, it can make a difference from a life-saving standpoint. If you missed the booth today, you can catch it on our website at stj.com. St. John's mission is to continually offer avenues to improve overall community health and wellness. Today's Life Care is one of the ways that we do that. As you can probably tell, today is also about honoring those who have served in our armed forces. And I would like to take a moment and ask those of you who are veterans, or have relatives that are veterans, if you would take a moment and stand that we could recognize you. Thank you for all you've done. And in keeping with our military theme, you won't want to miss our next special guest, none other than the favorite Corporal Matt Quinter. I'd like to thank you all again for helping make St. John's 21st Health Fair a success. And now, the moment you've all been waiting for. James Farr has delighted us with his talent for over half a century. His feature film credits include Blackboard Jungle, Cannonball Run, and Cannonball Run 2. Farr also appeared as a regular on the Red Skelton Show, but he's probably best remembered for his role in the award-winning television series MASH. Children's presentation, MASH, they brought generations of watchers together. Its success is no doubt due to Farr's contribution. So please join me. Farr is the only member of the cast to have served 2 years in the armed forces in Korea. Farr is now an LPGA tournament, named in his honor, and yearly charity golf classic that attracts a ton of female golfers from around the world, and has also raised $3 million for local charities. That is $5 million.
That's right.
So without further ado,
I can love them. basiality. He used to live with a singer who stuttered. And one day, George was coming back to his apartment. He opened the door, and the apartment was in total disarray. And George says to his buddy, he says, Maury, what happened? And Maury goes, George, you just do it. He says, Maury, I know you stutter when you talk, but you don't stutter when you sing. Sing it to me. And he goes, George, we've done this wrong. Now, George Burns and Jack Benny were two of the greatest friends. And George Burns used to love to play tricks on Jack Benny. And he would always set Jack Benny up. And one time they were in London at Buckingham Palace when the Queen was going to arrive. And they had all the people lined up. Everybody was in tuxedos, and some of the women were in beautiful evening gowns. And George was setting Jack Benny up. And he looked down at the aisle there and he goes, we gotta go. My wife doesn't like to go to the store. So he says, all right, I'll go. Now, he says, hey, I'm so happy that Mrs. Barr is coming with us. I want you to fly on my private plane. And I said, Mrs. Davis, I don't like to fly on private jets. I always go, you know, commercial. I guess this is all free. You'll love it. Wait, fly on the plane is very sick. So I said, all right. So my wife and I get on the airplane, and who do you think's on the airplane? Lucille Ball. Lucille Arnett, Mr. and Mrs. Allen, Mr. and Mrs. Danny Davis Jr., Mr. and Mrs. Gregory Day, and Mr. and Mrs. Harry Rankin are all on the airplane. The plane lands in Denver, Colorado. We're all getting off the airplane, and Mrs. Davis comes up and he says, well, Jake, what did you say? What did that happen? Mrs. Davis, don't you ever do that to me again. He said, what do you mean? What is the plane? The plane was wonderful, sir. But I said, do you realize if that plane had crashed, I was not the last building to the obituary column. Now we go back to the event. There's caviar, there's champagne all over the place. Now, my wife is a very attractive lady. I'm really blessed that I'm married to this beautiful lady. And she is a nicely endowed lady. I guess what you young people call say now that she has a nice rack that we can say, I don't know if that's better. And anyway, that particular evening, she puts on a very low-cut dress, and we're going around talking to everybody. Margaret Davis, his wife, is bringing Henry Kissinger around to meet everybody, because I had met Henry Kissinger as a congressman man. So, you probably don't know this about it. Henry was quite the ladies' man. So he is Davis, who, of course, you know Danny, and this is Mrs. Danny's wife. Well, Henry zeroed in on my wife's sleeve. Never took his eyes off that line of wife. Never looked her in the eye one time. He said, well, I'd like to meet you up, Mrs. Mark. Very good. So we have some small talk, some small conversation, and he's going to walk away. Like, very nice to meet you again, Mr. Secretary. And my wife says, nice talking to you, Henry. So they walk away, and I turn to my wife, I said, you know, Joy, I said, either say Mr. Kissinger or Mr. Secretary, how can you call Henry? He looked at me, he said, Jamie, if you can look at my boobs, I can call Henry. Now we're sitting at the big dais there, and Henry Winkler is on the dais, Chuck Norris is on the dais, and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Perry Mann and Donald Sutherland are down the other side. And it was the head of the studio, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, like, he and I like to star every once in a while. So, Alan Dershowitz, who was the head of the studio, bought us up a couple of steps, and he wanted Arnold down to the other end and handed me one over there. At that time, it was okay. It was appropriate after dinner to light the cigar. So we crimped our cigars, and I lit up my cigar, and I was really enjoying it. And I see Donald Sutherland, who's sitting next to Arnold Schwarzenegger, come over to me and say, Jay, would you mind putting that cigar out? It's annoying, Mr. Carey Manning. And I said, well, you know, it's not a vanity cigar. You mind if I don't put it out? I can just let it burn out so that it doesn't, that I can enjoy it a little later. He says, yeah, that's okay. And he started very quickly, Donald. I said, you're sitting next to Arnold. And Arnold's smoking a cigar. Why don't you ask him to put his cigar out? He thought, well, you know, Jamie, if I'd done that, I would have sent him a note and signed him a phantom. Now, after the evening, we go home, we start to go back. We land in the private airplane, land at the Santa Monica airport. I mean, we have just seen all the millionaires and diamonds and emeralds and everything else. My flight goes up to the chauffeur, who's waiting for us. He says, quick, drive us to a ghetto. Oh, you know what? That story reminds me. I did a show. Called No Have to Be Jewish. It's a very funny TV, and it reminds me of one of the stories with all the diamonds and everything else that was there. We did it at Nancy Hall, around the family. And one of the stories is about these two ladies that are talking, and the lady says, my goodness, look at that lady. She says, that's a beautiful ring. She says, yes, yes. She says, how many carats is that? That's about 16, 17 carats. between the Hope Diamond and the Star of India. The Hope Diamond and Star of India. Says, does it have a name? He says, yes, it's called the Plotkin Diamond.
A Plotkin Diamond?
I never heard of it. It comes with a curse. What's the curse? It's a Plotkin. Now, my wife has been on a lot of television shows with me. There is a show called Cattletales with Bert Cartier. We did one called The Mike Douglas Show, the space in Philadelphia. He's the forerunner, actually, the Oprah Winfrey. Mike's show is on every afternoon. So Mike invited me to go to the Philadelphia show and bring joy with him. And I said, I feel great. You're going to love Philadelphia. The history that's there in Philadelphia, the independent home and everything else. So we get to the theater, and we're discussing backstage, and my wife tears her pantyhose. Now, what I didn't tell you was in 1994, I had done a Bob Holmes special on NBC, where I show up in the same dress that Milton Berle was wearing. And they had given me some pantyhose. And I didn't wear them, I had packed them in my suitcase. So when my wife wore a pantyhose, I said, don't worry, I got a pair of them. Now, what husband, you know, can give your wife a pair of pantyhose and go on stage on a television show? So I can give you the pantyhose, and she would not. That night, she took her out and said, okay, you got to go to his confessions hall. Local readers, this is where John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, was cold. He stood out of the storm cellar, looked into the windows, and everything else. There's where they were. That's where they intended. This is exciting. I told the taxi driver, hey, you wait there, keep the meter running. I said, look at this, it's a Liberty Bell. Look at it. You know, I really am impressed. Actually, I thought you would be this is the bell for this game. I said, no, not with this. The fact that you let the taxi meter run in the alley. I know you finally made it. Now, I know you're waiting for me to tell you some stories about MASH. But, you know, before MASH, I told you that I had done a movie called Blackboard Jungle, which introduced rock and roll. That was Bill Haley in the comics, Rock Around the Fire. That started Led Zeppelin, Sidney Poitier, Paul Mercer, Steve McMorrow. And at the time, that was my very first movie. I was under my real name, which was Jamil Joseph Farah. I don't know whether you can send. Now, you know many stars change their names. I don't know if you know that. I guess Brad Pitt had changed his name with George Clooney or Angelina Jolie. But a lot of stars did, hopefully you remember some of them. I'm going to give you a neat one name, I think. You know who Bernie Schwartz was? You have any idea? Yell it out, you know. That's correct. Bernie Schwartz, oh, you heard it. That was the easy one. Barry Morris, that was the easy one. John Wayne, that's right, see? Doris Kasselbaum. Doris Day, you got it. Gret Austerlitz. Gret Austerlitz. But it's there, you got it, that's right. Now we get a little number. This is a good game, here's the good one. Mira Palmer. Anybody know Mira Palmer one? Jane Mansfield. That was her name. This is a tough one. Who was Eugene Maurice Horowitz? Mike Sanders, you got it, that's exactly right. Can you believe that? And here's one that you won't believe. I hope you get this one. Ishtar Van Yelagin. Kurt Douglas, that's right, it is Kurt Douglas. Leonard Slager. Roy Rogers, there you go. Now I'm going to give you one. Alfonso de Alonso.
Alan Alda.
That's correct, you're the only one. You got it right. Alfonso de Alonso is Alan Alda. That's Alan's real name. You got three strong ones in that. Was Alfonso de Alonso. Jack Benny's real name is Bert, Denny Cavalcini, and George Burns' real name was Nathaniel Birdbaum. Anyway, back to Blackboard Jungle, that was my first movie. He introduced the great rock around the clock, and that was during the star system. Elizabeth Taylor, Clark Gable, Gene Kelly, everybody was on that lot. Now, here's the kid from North Bend, Toledo, Ohio. One year, I was just in the Rose Valentine Theater watching an MGM movie. And the next year, I'm on the MGM lot making a movie. Man's name, who was the guard of the gate, ironically enough, was Ken Hollywood. That was his name. We go on that, that this is something that doesn't happen today, but it's moving the air, we have to today, you actually saw. You young people, you don't know, you see Warner Brothers, you see MGM, they're just like corporations, those people are long gone out, but who is the man who's actually there? And as I told my friend, Greg Skelton, he was doing that, and Red was under contract with MGM, and Red had served in World War II, and he came home on parole one time and went into Mr. Mayor's office, and Mr. Mayor said, Red, how was the honor? He says, well, sir, he says, it's okay, and I'm don't think you get 3 square foot a day. He says, oh, yes, that's the reason you get 3 square foot a day. He says, what about clothing? He says, oh, clothing, we got clothes for the winter, we got clothes for the summer, and the spring, we got clothes. What about the housing? He says, housing, no, we've got a roof overhead, and answer. But Mr. Mayor says, well, Red, what is it about the army you don't like? And Red looked at him and says, bullets, Mr. Mayor, bullets. Red was like my father. He was a great man. I spent a lot of time with him. I had done a pilot at the CBS in the South, and Sherwood Schwartz was with, that's right, you know, Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch. He decided to add my character to the plate in this pilot. There was a shell show when the characters were ready to play Dead Eye, so forth. So I met Red, and I went again and I said, Red was a very, very wonderful man. He'd have very funny sayings. For example, he'd take the saying, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. Red used to say, familiarity breeds contempt. There are more old drunks than there are old doctors. Harry Collins, who was the head of Columbia Studios, was not a nice man. That was at the time when he was a single woman. Everybody disliked Harry Collins. So when Harry Cohen died, 5,000 people turned out. And Red said to the press, you see, when you give the people what they want, they'll turn out. She told me, Debbie told me that I hope they all turned in until we open. The day tomorrow in the morning classic, presented by Kroger, this is my 24th year with them. We collected $5 million for abuse to children and battered wives. We had 12 or 14 young people in colleges and universities all over the United States under my name. And I have some golf things to say. This is a very famous one. There's a couple of sounding golf courses around the world that you probably know. One of them is Augusta, where they play the Masters. Another one is L.A. Country Club in Los Angeles. L.A. Country Club does not allow Jews, Blacks, nor actors. And Hillcrest Country Club, where George Burns belonged, was a Jewish country club that started in part of the LA Country Club, would not allow them. Well, Randolph Scott, the great Western actor, went to join the LA Country Club. And they said, I'm sorry, Mr. Scott, it's not allowed. It's not allowed to choose Blacks or actors. And Randolph Scott said, I have 85 films to prove I'm not an actor. Now, Hillcrest Country Club was the Jewish country club, and one day the LA Country Club said, okay, we're going to allow one Jewish person to become a member of the country club. They went in and that's it. So Hillcrest said, okay, if they let in somebody who's Jewish, we're going to let in somebody who's Christian. Who do you think the Christian was that Hillcrest Country Club let in? Danny Thomas. And somebody said, you're going to let in a Christian, let in a Christian who looks like a Christian. It's a tough crowd, isn't it? Anyway, Groucho Marx, if you remember Groucho, Groucho Marx did not belong to Hillcrest Country Club. He said, I would never want to become a member of a club that would have me as a member. He was at the LA Country Club, and his daughter was in the swimming pool, and he was in the swimming pool, and they said, I'm sorry, Mr. Marks, we're not allowed, we don't allow Jewish people in the swimming pool. He said, well, my daughter's half Jewish, can she wave? Now, you so down on Park Lake Avenue, where many families from Toledo, Ohio, where I'm from, and Danny has a Park Lake Avenue. Danny's park is on the south side of Toledo, my park is on the north side of Toledo. Nobody city in the United States are, but you know this. Now, I'm telling you about Red because he was so important in my life. And there was a comedian, and I worked with all the great comedians, with Bob Holt, I worked with the girl with Danny Day, and Fred Shell, and Andy Griffith, and Steve Ball. He was a comedian, some of you might know, he was the first comedian to broadcast coast to coast on radio without a picture. His name was Ted Winter, and he was known as a perfect fool. You'll see him in old movies like Jerry Lewis's Sister Cullen and the other. And then there's a funny way he was talking to this film. And he actually worked in Longville. He worked with all the W.C. Fields and Danny Rice and Tom Hanks. And he still would be with the old well and home. Oh, more pepper. Oh, needs more salt. Oh, needs more pepper. Oh, needs more salt. Oh, needs more pepper. What do you think? Salt and pepper. Well, Ed was like Red's father, just like Red was mine. Take it back to 1920. It's a very good story. I love the story. It's a little boy standing on a street corner in a small town in Indiana, and he's selling these pictures. And he's really trying to get all these papers sold. And a very distinguished man in a Hamburg hat and a coat. He said, young man, you're really trying to sell all these newspapers. He says, why is that? Oh, sir. He says, my favorite comedian is in town playing at the State Theater. And if I sell all my newspapers, I'll be able to go and see him. And the man says, well, who's the comedian? Ed Wynn. He says, Ed Wynn. You know, young man, he says, I know the manager, the stage manager of that theater. He said, I'm going to buy all your newspapers. And now we don't have enough money to buy your ticket. And I'm going to give you a card, sign this card. You present that to the stage manager. And then you go backstage, and I'll let you be able to meet the Ed Wynn. He says, oh, well, thank you, sir. That is absolutely wonderful. So a little boy goes to the stage theater, and he was great to be in it. And he used to have glasses on. But he used to do. Very interesting things, like a piano bicycle that he would ride across the stage playing the piano on it. And he did all kinds of amazing things. As a matter of fact, one time, Thomas Alva Edison was in the audience, and he was so amazed that Ed, when he came backstage one time, he said to Ed, do you mind if I ask you a personal question? He said, not at all, Mr. Edison. He said, that piano bicycle, he says, where in the world did you come up with all those crazy inventions? Man invented the light bulb, the movies, the photograph, but he didn't come up with all those crazy inventions. Anyway, the little boy he went with goes backstage and hands his car and statement. Oh, yes, the wind is waiting for you. Go down the hall and stop at the door there. You just knock on it and the wind will take a look. The little boy goes over there, knocks on the door, and gives his boy to come in. He opens the door. There in front of the makeup, taking off his paper. The gentleman in the Hamburg hat and suit is Ed Wynn. The little boy is Red Skelton. That is a true story. And Ed was to Red as Red was to me. And you know, I was a little boy when I grew up, and I used to listen to his radio shows, and I must tell you, I had no idea that I would be with Red. And I was one of his ball bearers. Can you imagine this man who knew all the things of people in the world? And I'd just like to read you what was said. This is Red. This was Red to do as he did so. My thanks, dear heart. I love you one and all. You were my audience, my family, my friends. You were my reason for being. I gave my all. I tried my best. I have been rewarded in many ways. I have lived a good life, and I've seen so much theaters like Palace's Heart of Gold, the Dory Monuments, Bar and Bottom. Blank, I filled with colorful clowns, and black pages and filled with gentle stories, and music was composed. I loved my country, I served with pride, I worship God, they think of good, we just about to go. I leave you now, my journey is long. Brad, I love you, I just want you to know it. What a great man. Many people ask me, last week we're going to have a reunion. I say, you know what? I don't think so. We wind up being well at the patients and the doctors and nurses. When we were young, we had a meeting right in the rhythm of technology with the three Qs, paradoxes, podiatrists, and proctologists. Now, I'm often asked, how did I get the role of clinic? Well, I got to say, in show business, it follows, you can say, one day you're eating chicken, the next day you're fucking with vegetables. At this particular time of my life, I was working with veterans. I was out of work. I had done a show called Guest Food. Remember that? With Ken Terry and Ward Tucker. And there was a director on it by the name of Gene Reynolds. I had played this stand-up comic comedian that Howie Drive was auditioning. And I had all these one-liner jokes, you know, like, instead of take my rifle, please, take my swab, please. And then at the end of the day, I said, we bombed out. And how he says, don't smoke cigarettes, don't smoke cigarettes. Well, Gene Reynolds went on to become the producer of the show called Man. I never seen the movie. And the show wasn't on air, wasn't on television. So I get a phone call from my agent. Gene Reynolds wants you to come to the studio at 27th in the park and enter this new series called Man. And I said, well, what's the part? Don't worry about it. Gene will have it for you when you get there. And I needed the money. I said, is it paid? He said, yeah, you can only give you the day's worth. So I arrived at the studio and Gene took me into a trailer that was outside Stage 9. And in the trailer was a wax uniform, an army wax uniform hanging up. And ideally, we were about 5, 17, or 18, you know, hanging in the nature. And I said, gee, I must be dressing with an actor to come in. That's yours, put him on. I said, you got it, you're kidding. You want me to put that idea? Yeah, that's the part. I said, what the heck, stop that, you're going to stop this. So I put this wax out and I put this huge tiny deal with these back then. Those hairy bone bags. And he escorted me, sorry about it, he escorted me at Stage 9. And Alan Alda and the crew, they are all about that. They said, you have plenty of things to do. And I had a couple of lines in the show. And the general that I confronted was shown by the actor named Soro Wolf. He was Boss Pasta. He had a group of ashes. He was the first general that Corporal Winger encountered. So I had these few lines on the show. Got big laughs. And I was sent home. I got, you know, you hear about these big challenges, right? That I didn't get the, like, friends of people to get $1 billion an episode. And, you know, I got $250 today. This is what I said. I came on to one day and I stayed for 11 years. That ain't a bad parlor, did I? What happened is I did 6 more shows. The second year I did half of the shows, 13 shows, and the final of the third year they put me as a contract. Okay? Now I'm going to tell you something about the show. MASH was on Sunday night at 8 o'clock at night. It was on opposite the wonderful world of Disney. There were 65 television shows on at that time. And MASH was number 56. We were going to be next. You know what they do? A lady who happens to be the wife of the chairman of CBS. Name is Dave Haley. Bill Haley is the chairman. And I guess if you sleep with the chairman and you want to show Dave on the air, you keep that show on the air. Bill Haley is sleeping with Dave Haley every night, all right? Dave Haley says, Bill, I like the show. Put it on and keep it on. So Bill Haley said, all right. The next year, it was on Saturday night, the greatest night in the history of television. Started with all of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, MASH, the Bob Newhart Show, and the Carol Burnett Show. No one went out of their house on that night. They didn't go to restaurants, they didn't go to movie theaters, they didn't go anywhere. It was the biggest night in the history, and since that time period, there's never been a night like that in television. And you know what the Nielsen was, what they checked out on? When the commercials came out, everybody went to the bathroom, and that's how they knew the water level went down, because everybody came home and knew that. MASH stayed on for 11 years, and as she told me, we had the highest rating, we still have the highest rating, and we'll never be beat, because there were three networks at that time, February 28, 1983. There were 200 million people in the United States of America, and 145 million people watched that final episode. It was never be top. You saw the Super Bowl last night, 90 some million. Heavy, because now you have four networks at all the people. And even though we had 300 million people, you'll never, ever, ever get a rating like that in the history of television. And it's wonderful to be part of that, okay? MASH is the end of the book. MASH has won the Peabody Award, has won all kinds of Emmy Awards. It was probably considered the best guy for the best show that was ever written or was ever on television. And I agree with you. And my character was absolutely wonderful. He was very, very bizarre. Everybody loved the character. I tried to get out of the army so many different times. I tried one time by trying to emulate myself with gasoline by using water. And I then wound up, somebody asked me to put gasoline in. I said, who put gasoline in my gasoline? I tried to fly over the compound and fly over and see if you can. On one of them, I tried to get out by being pregnant. I tried to eat my way out. I tried to sweat my way out. I dressed as the Statue of Liberty, if you remember that one, it was General MacArthur. I undressed as Lady Godiva. I was Moses. I was the Toledo Strangler. I tried to get out by telling the Colonel, like the Colonel, I'd have to go home. My two brothers, Maurice and Hakeem, died and exploded to the basement of the Toledo Harmonic Effect. I tried to get out by telling him I was a communist. Said Bolshevik? I said, no, sir, not. I think you want to know what I've been doing lately. I'll go into a Q&A in a moment, but I want to tell you something. I'm doing a game show in Las Vegas. You ever get over there? It's at the Hilton Hotel. It's called $250,000 Game Show Spectacular. Bob Eubanks hosted, and I hosted. It's an in-house game show. We play the Bobby show, we play the Newlywed Game, we play any of that new card chart. It's done every day. I'll be flying back here to do that. I finished a wonderful movie with Ernie Borgnine last year called Grandfather Christmas. It's on the Hallmark Channel. Ernie was nominated for a Golden Globe for that. I'll probably be doing a show on Broadway in August. And I will be at the Overland Park, the Overland Park Dance, the new theater, March 2009. I've already signed to do 12 weeks there at a show called Home Press and Dinner. Now, you're probably thinking, why is Game Show the game show? Why is it called the game show? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I did more game shows than any white guy. I did more game shows than anybody, even though we didn't host them, than anybody in the world. And there's a famous game show story. I don't know if you ever heard of this one. Happy and Monty Hall used to have a show called Let's Make a Deal. Monty had a show called Split Second. It didn't last very long, Monty, and not either. And it was going off the air, and his announcer, Jay Stewart, was with them. And they were in commercial break. And Monty said to Jay, he said, Jay, you know, do we have any money left in the kitchen? He said, yeah, Monty, you got about $20. He said, you know what? There's a way to do this. He said that every show is just in the front row there. When we come out of commercial, I'm going to say to that lady, what's your name? She'll tell me. And I'll say, who is the first man? She'll say, Adam. We'll give it $400. So they come out and say, thank you very much, ladies, you know, you've been wonderful, we've got a fine lesson, so, and I want to appreciate the loyalty that you've given. So, Jay, who has money in the case? He has money, he has $400. Man, you citizens are so fair. You've been here every show, half a question. What are your circumstances? To say, all right, save for $400. Who was the first man? She looked at Monty and said, you know, Monty, for $1,000, I would have done that. Now, I don't know whether Debbie told you or not, but as I look back at my career, I really do feel like Jimmy Stewart is a wonderful life. I had one of those really long moments in my career. I don't know if you mentioned, I did a movie called The Greatest Story Ever Told, which was George Stevens' movie. And at this particular time, things were not going well. I was engaged with my wife, engaged with my fiance, and I was practically broke. I had no money. And there was this movie that George Stevens was going to make called The Greatest Story Ever Told. So I called my agent and said, you know what? There's got to be something. My face. There's got to be something in that movie. All right? So he says, okay, but can you give it a try? I had this little car, a Renault car, not a car, and I used to take my wife, my fiance, to work every morning to a little church nearby. And she stopped at that church. And I remember, and Thomas, he led the meeting. I led the meeting. And Thomas made the same to you. He said, you make things happen in my life. I was going to decline to you. And of course, he did. You got the St. Jude Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. So I said, no one. And he's from Toledo. I'm from Toledo. He's Lebanese. I'm Lebanese. I'm going to ask St. Jude. Good job. So every day I go in my lane. And I can say, St. Jude, there's got to be a part of that for me in that movie. So I go home. I think he's called his name. He's Stevens. He wants to see the film. I think he had anything serious. I said, sure. I got to get a thing for the Western. They had to play a very serious role in that. I'll go to the producer and ask him for the film. So I went to the producer, got the film, and let it go up to Stevens' office. I went back to Mario, and I said, the word of the prayer to the church, he said, boy, he said, I paid him. He's got to be something in the picture because I had no money. I had told me how I had no unemployment. I had nothing. There was no hope for me. So I tried to hand on to a quarter of it and three. My agent called me and said, Jamie, I don't know how to fix this, but they don't want you in the movie. Go pick up the film. So I went, I picked up the film. Next morning, my fiance said, I stopped off at the church and I called St. Jude off. I got mad at him. I actually called him off. I said, I'm not going to hand over, I'm not giving you a quarter. The heck with it. You know, he gave you something for me, forget it. What am I supposed to do? Something to do with the assistant partner? Forget it. So I walked out. That night, he told my agent, Jamie, I don't know what happened. But I took the first offer to give a 26-week guarantee on the picture for $450 a week to the Lady Apostles and Daniel $500. Oh, my God, that's wonderful. Go down to the studio the next day and do a wardrobe test and pay up. So I go to the studio to talk to Esther, of course, and Roddy McDowell, all these names, they were going to take the wardrobe test. Take my wardrobe test. Come home, tell them, I guess, I ate it again. He's saying, it's okay. Same deal, 26 weeks, $450 a week. They look at the test. They don't want you to play the Daniel $1,000. They want you to play the Apostle Daniel. Oh, okay, great. So I called the money and I said, hey, Mitch, 26 weeks of the movie, $450 a week. So what do you think? I said, I'll play this Apostle Daniel. He said, Daddy? I said, yeah, you know what that apostle's old name is? I said, no. He said, it's St. Jude Daddy. How long that thing you say? That great. Is that incredible? Is that a great story? I've had a wonderful life. Okay. Okay, I'm gonna open it up for you. I got some outside to show you, but I'm gonna open it up and have any questions you wanna ask about anything, about show business. Yes, sir, stand up. What's my favorite episode of MASH was? I think it was the one called The Reporter with Lee Roberts. We had to get that in the show. I don't know if anybody knew that. You know, our show, most shows are all scripted. That particular show, we had them, they gave us questions, and we answered it as our character. It's a two-part, it was black and white, and that's the one where Robert Mulcahy tells you to put his hands into the body, to keep his hands warm. That actually happened in Korea with one of the doctors. That was a totally accurate show. Imagine that. Where in the world did the producers and directors allow actors to make up dialogue? That sounds good, the cast was, but that's probably the biggest. The funniest thing was, the one with MacArthur, where I showed up at the Statue of Liberty, so I'll tell you what happened. We shoot it in a place like this, like an airport hangar, right out loud. And we go home every night. We don't know what people, how to react to our jokes. I go home, I cook my family, then we're hanging up, I go to work again. So you walk out and see the public, you let us know whether you like it or not. You let us know whether the shows are funny. The next day, after I'd seen that show with Joseph MacArthur, who needed to be a Statue of Liberty, but he paid no attention to the rest of the camp, so you see the Statue of Liberty stands up and salutes it, and I got the horse there. I was in Beverly Hills, and I was walking down the street, and a cab driver and bus driver were off on the horn, laughing and just giving me all kinds of okay signs. They said that that was one of the funniest moments in all the television that people who are at home by themselves watching the show actually fell out of the chair laughing. It was almost as funny as the famous Jack Benny radio show where the man comes up, you know, Jack Benny was supposed to be very cheap if you don't know that or not. And this is a famous line that came up where it was on the earth with a gun in his back. And he says, your money or your life. And there's this long pause. And the man says, your money or your life. And Jack Benny says, I'm thinking, okay. That went on for the minute. Crazy. Well, he said the same thing happened when I showed up at the end of that episode. That's rumored. Anybody else? Yes? You talked about the movie. You want to know what happened to Henry Clay as a Clay Stevens. Here's an interesting story. You know, McLean Stevens was the original Henry Clay. And what networks like to do, because MASH has to be so popular, this is to show you how easy to get a network set. When a show is popular, another network will try to capture one of your main characters from that show, or the actor from that show, to try to weaken the show. And so NBC was romancing McLean Stevens to take over the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. So they had made an offer to McLean, they even allowed him to co-host some of the evenings, you know, to replace Johnny Carson. So they romanced McLean, his contractor, and had his wife. And so McLean was going to leave the show and go to NBC. Now, here's the interesting thing. That final episode that you talked about, where to leave the show, we shot the show where we say goodbye to him on the helipad. I was wearing a Carmen Miranda outfit. And the funny thing is that I actually existed, and I turned around, my life was up, sir. He does that, gets on the helicopter, and flies off. And that was the end of my shooting, it was the end of Loretta Swift's shooting process. We get a phone call, they had to come back, and said they had a new scene. What could they possibly have? He came to the set, and they took the cast members aside. The crew, camera crew did not know what was going on. The extras did not know. This is the main cast. And they handed us this one page that we had never seen. And on the page is where Gary Herbaugh, the creator, comes into the operating room and says, Colonel Blake's helicopter has been shot down over the sea of the land, and there are no survivors. Well, I can't tell you how effective all of us. We couldn't believe they were going to do this, because this has never happened before. In any television series ever, would they kill off a member of a major member of the cast? What they wanted to do was to show you, the public, that war is ugly. You knew people lose loved ones in the war. And Henry Blake was a very loved character, and they wanted to give you the impact that you lost somebody very close to you in the war. Now, there were some cast members that didn't quite agree with that, but we all did. They never told the camera crew, and they never told the editor. So the next time that show's on here, you see that? You see the reaction of those faces. We did it with two cameras, so we didn't have to do it twice. You'll see, you won't believe that you can't see their mouths because of the band of it, but you watch their eyes. They are totally shocked that they had never heard that before. So that's what they did. You listen to that. And you know what? Patrick is a great guy. He passed away. He passed away. Matt was one of the kindest people. He founded the Burn Foundation, and he did a lot for children that got burned. He needed plastic surgery and everything else. Max died 5 years ago. He had to have a bypass, and he actually had a heart attack on the burning. He died on the burning after the operation. So he was a beautiful man. They all loved him. Max dressed a wife and a daughter. And NBC never really fulfilled their. They did that to try to get him out of the show. And our show got lost a lot of cast members. The show got to stay popular. They couldn't hurt us at all, you know. Any other questions? Yeah? My character? Yes, my character is from Toledo. No, what happened was he wanted to know why was my character from Toledo. My character was the only one that was from Toledo. The Plain Stevenson character was from Illinois, and Matt was originally from Illinois, from Bloomington. You know, his cousin was Abby Stevenson, who ran for president of the United States. That's what Matt and Chet said. Matt's cousin was the Plain Stevenson. Jerry Gerbach was not from the Commonwealth, and Nate Burns was Fort Wayne, Indiana. I was the only one who was originally from there. How that happened was Gene Reynolds used to be from Cleveland, and then he moved to Detroit. And Larry Delbar, creating my character, used to write Sid Caesar, wrote Funny Thing I'm Not Afraid of War. How that worked out was his father was a barber, and all the comedians went to Harry Delbar's barber shop, Milton Burrow, Kevin Thompson, and Harry, his son Larry, who was a student at Fairfax High School, said he was a good writer. And he brought him over to Danny Thomas, who was from Toledo. And Larry Delbar sold his very first joke to Danny Thomas. So that was the payback. They thought that that would be a good way to present Danny, that they would make a corporate leader from taking revenue and also make him from the city of Toledo, Ohio. So, yes. He's asking me about the places that I mentioned in Toledo that are a real place. That happened in the show I told you about, it was called The Reporter, where we had it. Yes, there is a Tony Packer there. Tony Packer's hot dog and chili will give you more gas than Pittsburgh. Everybody in that final episode wanted to know if there was a real Tony Packer. They called up and they ordered hot dogs and chili sauce and everything else. They ate them that night while the show was on the air. There really is a real budget. The only team made that, they're the farm team of the Detroit Tigers. All the other things I mentioned, there really are. In the city, I can go to my childhood memory. Yes, sir?
Can you tell me about the
Tiger
Woods
family? Yes, sir. I mentioned earlier that did some episodes of. We did two. You wanted to know how many shows were we had in the show. We did two of the shows. One was a reporter that we talked about. The other one is giving an episode where I'm showing a movie and the projector keeps breaking down and everybody has to get up and do something. That was that one. Everybody had to do that particular show. We did two of them. I don't think any show ever, you can go look at all the histories of shows. You can see a ball show. The Happy Day, the Urban Shirley show, no one had a good show. There would be only a ones that were allowed to do that. Yes? Say yes? I was not in Korea anymore. I was in Korea. Okay? was in Korea, what happened is, I stationed in the Takamatsu, Japan, the Armed Forces Radio, and when Red Skelton brought his son, Richard, from the TV, Red came over to Japan, and he wanted to entertain the troops all the way up to the DMZ of 38 parallel. I was stationed in Japan. Red requested me from the State Department. I was really private, and I got CIA staff, flew to the United Nations Airport, and we traveled all the way from Japan, all the way up to the demarcation zone where everybody was pointing sunsets at each other. And Red and I entertained the troops all the way up there. And when it was all over, Red was going to go back to America, and he said, you know, Jimmy, when you get out of the army, it's going to be tough. It's going to be hard to get your career going. You come and see me. And I said, do you have anything to say? And say, you know, are you going to believe that? I got out of the army and came home. My father passed away. We had no money. I was going to have to go home and support my family. And I went to Red and said, "Fine. You're not me. I made you a promise. You're like me, a doctor of comedy. You sit in pocket, pulled out several $100 bills, and none of the personal contracts that he had up right now. And I was with Red for a couple of years after that. That's the kind of guy he was. Okay, now you're really trying to hurt me. If he asked you a question, whatever happened to the show, it's been also after that. I asked the same question. I'll admit it, I asked the same question. What had happened was, when you have somebody on the show like Alan Alda, who is a very, very powerful person and has the influence in the show and gets that kind of credit, he can maintain the quality of the show. Harry Morgan and Bill Christopher and I didn't have that kind of modesty. We didn't have that. So we got these other writers in, and what they did is rather than stay with what brought them there, they brought in characters that were very deep, and they didn't stay with it, they stayed with the money, with the people that brought them there, okay? And the show was never the problem. They changed all the philosophy of the show and everything else. And actually, I got into a lot of trouble because I tried to fight them on that. I wound up in the National Enquirer, and I was saying bad things about the show, and I did all. It was a really ugly period in my life. So I'm glad you brought that up, though. I said, something I can take home with you when I get to California. What do you got? You got something from Aftermath? Okay, well, after you, yes, sir. No, the actors have to go through a medical or military training. We have, you're going to see in one of the outtakes, our technical advisor, who is a doctor, Dr. Michelle. He, in one of the outtakes, you'll see him. He's in civilian clothes. He doesn't know the camera's going. He walks by the screen and doing the outtakes. And the cast says, you see him. So you'll see that in one of the outtakes. What they had to do was learn certain things. You know, many of the things that. Yes. Well, you'll see that on some of the outlets. Was it difficult for us to keep a straight face and speak? It was extremely difficult. Harry Morgan is the biggest pixie in the world, I gotta say. So you don't want to look into his eyes when you're doing the speech, because there's all nothing but twinkling going on in there. He's a pixie. Harry Morgan is coming to be on April the 10th. That's a good guess. Very important. Isn't that doctor? Yes, you know what? Harry is really bad. One of the most dangerous actors you ever worked with. It's getting crazy. Gary Murbaugh, what around Gary? You know, Gary got upset. He didn't want to do the Teddy Bear radar thing. He thought he was being typecast and thing. So he left the show. That's why I get called as a company clerk. Gary went up for Gary did they in a top piece painter for water art, good things like autopsy. He used to do love birds and animal life and everything else. Does not fly. Doesn't fly in a little camper. And he does some theater work now and then. He just sort of kind of got out of it. He lost interest in his career. can enjoy it. He is really, he's a talented musician, he's a talented artist, and he's just a wonderful human being. But he's just kind of, we rarely see him. He's one of the few people. I'll tell you, see all the time, Loretta Flynn and I, Mike Farrell, and William Christopher and Harry Morgan, who go out to dinner together. Alan Lawler lives on the East Coast, who lives in New York, because of the town we all get together. We don't see David Oxenshire, who's Major Winchester, and Larry Winslow died several years ago. So, imagine this someplace, on the ocean somewhere. Yes. When this character took over the company clerk, I want to make sure everybody hears it. Yes, but I took over. Okay, just say, you know what? We all have a lot of input in all of our characters. We were one of the first cast that would tell you when we read a script. We would say, you know what? I wouldn't say this line. I think Bill Christie would say that line. Now, what actually do you know? And when he goes there, actually, yes, we'll give away lines. Usually they want more lines. We would say, I wouldn't say that. I remember there was one time on the Green Garden meeting. Honey, right? We had so many famous actors on our show. Denny, Patrick Swayze, Ronnie Howard, and we had a ton of actors that came to our show. There was one with Gregory Harrison where I was supposed to meet all his names with Gregory Harrison. Quayne wouldn't do that. You know, he just wouldn't do that. Maybe he could get diverted in that house when somebody gets in it. He wouldn't fall asleep. That would be the that would really be a violation of his of what he does. It's always been so easy to put anybody in check. Yes, sir. Did I wear real dresses? Yes, I did wear real dresses. Some of those real dresses are from the Smithsonian Institute, Washington, D.C. How's that? You know, the Smithsonian a few years ago had an exhibit that went out all around the country. They took 16 items out of the Smithsonian show. And one of them was the Mankind Orchestra, along with Abraham Lincoln's top hat, the first spaceship that we had, and John Lennon went up in, and the table and chairs were leading during the interview with General Grant. We were one of the items, and we imagine that the signpost that we had out of the ground. Was Alan Alda a humorist? Yes, he was. And Alan was a wonderful writer and he's a wonderful human being. You know, his father was Robert Alda, the actor. Robert Alda was the original Sky Masterson in the Broadway show Guys and Dolls. And Robert Alda was on our show several times. Robert Alda was a song and dance man in nightclubs. And Alan, as a little boy, used to travel with him. And he would have the apartment under the above where Robert Alda would be performing. And Alan used to fall asleep every night in his father's feet. Well, do, da 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 da. Robert Alda had a heart attack and went into a coma. And Alan used to visit his dad, I knew Bob very, very well. I love Bob. He was a wonderful, wonderful human being. You know that the only way Alan could reach his father was he would hum the silver in the ear. And exactly, he would be able to communicate with him. That's fascinating. Back in the early 50s, you were living in Toledo, Ohio. I don't owe you money, right? In Maumee, Ohio, we lived in Maumee. He said if he had two boys, he used to play with him over the county fairground. I see him too. I rarely went out to Lucas County Fairground. The interesting thing, you know, that park that was named after the city of Toledo, that was Riverside Park, And I used to get a spanking from my mother for taking my wagon there. My mother wasn't alive at the time. She was going to tell her, hey, give me a spanking for going to my own park, you know. But she wasn't alive yet. I wasn't allowed to go. Lucas County was a long way off. We had to take lessons, so I probably wouldn't be there. Yes, ma'am. What was my favorite dress in the cleaner collection? Probably my clothes from the wind out.
Somebody else has to.
Anybody? Yes. Where were the outside stones done? It was done in Alamo Canyon, not far from where I live, in Southern California, in Japan. Today's park, they just put up some of the fence there for people who go to the state park to be able to see what's going on. Yes. You watch cash. Every afternoon on the Hallmark Channel, probably. Okay, on our local station. He watches all for making any money off of the show. Yes, I go to the mailbox. I'm due home shortly. Okay? My objection is the bankrupt Rupert Murdoch, okay? If I sent me $1,000, I couldn't do that. That's my objection. Yes, yes, sir. You still get the check. Good, that's less than 3 hours ago for that. You know, I can tell you about a 3 hours ago. You know when the first 3 hours ago car? Big Jack, car number one. Isn't that amazing? My car is under 6,000. That's how long I've been in the business. What happened to Trapper? That's the way you out. Saturday morning, you want to run Fox News. You start on the call. A very wealthy man, graduate of Princeton University. He was a big business investor. He used to invest money to his mother's brothers and her Griffith. He had a winery up in Northern California. Very, very, very wealthy man. Okay? Don't worry about Wayne Rodgers. Why did he leave? He got tired of it. Supposed to be a show that was between Alan Alda and himself, and they were never inviting him to Alan, and he didn't just want to be a guest man on the show. So Wayne left, got out of time. Okay, how about one more? Then let me show you the outfits that they go to. Go ahead. Did I enjoy the more comedy or the more serious things on the show? We always balance and go with one plot and subplot. I like silly stuff, you know. Sometimes you got to be serious on it. I love the silly stuff. I think that's a deep word joy. Especially, you know, you're in a situation where it's pretty serious there. You want that silliness, the bathtub and all the other things that we used to do, the Olympics, your special Olympics, and you go, yeah, you need the silly stuff. It's great. They were all wonderful. Okay, where's my buddy? Brian, are you right there? I'll stick out here and explain to these things. Some of them are self-explanatory. I'm sorry, there's some young people here. Harry Morgan doesn't want any of this. That is embarrassing, but all the scenes were in there. I couldn't cut them and edit them. So, I'm sorry. And a couple of them, remember Gwen Verdon, who's in Van Andy, she doesn't want to go. She does an expletive also. Harry says the worst expletive of all of them. You'll see it. Remember I told you the one that the doctor, you'll see that one who comes through with a civilian post. The other one is the Trapper Down series, Cardell Roberts comes through and surprises Mike Farrell. He has a urine specimen that he brings through in one of the scenes. So you'll see it. It's all self-explanatory. So if you wait.
Yeah, this is our company commander, Colonel Potter. Then our company for a complaint.
Colonel?